I'm Neil.
I'm James.
Let's review some things, James, and give them marks out of 10.
Is that it? Are we not going to ramble for 10 minutes?
No. Okay, get to see you. Go!
So what are we going to review first?
We are going to review the Olympics opening ceremony. The opening ceremony of the 2012 London Olympics. The spectacle of sporting fun and japes that is currently going on in, like, we're reviewing something that's actually happening at the moment, almost. Isn't this amazing?
It is. It's good. We are, well, except the fact it's probably going to take me about a month to get this, like, mixed together, and then it'll probably take you another month to put it on a website.
Yeah, other it'll than take that... me a month to upload a file. But there's a solid chance that we will actually get this out and on the internet within the year that the Olympics took place.
While it is still 2012.
So we're going to review the part of the Olympics that was the furthest ago, to make sure we're as untimely as possible. The opening ceremony.
To the opening ceremony, did you, Neil? That was quite a coup.
I didn't need tickets. I was invited.
Were you?
Because I'm special.
Were you the one in the top hat?
I was the child catcher.
So,
not in the ceremony, that was just my job. Yes,
stop all those urchins from ruining it for everyone else.
They've employed, roped in lots of volunteers and homeless people to serve as unofficial 2012 Team Olympic child catchers.
Yes. Did you get a t-shirt?
Got a lovely t-shirt, and I got a special badge for every child I caught.
That's good.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes.
It looks a bit like a child's scalp, but it isn't. That's important to note.
So the Olympics opening ceremony was the opening ceremony of the Olympics, as I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
So it's...
I don't feel like we need to explain too much about this because everyone in the world watched it, right? It was the highest rated thing on TV ever. That's a statistic I'm just throwing out there, but it's not far off being true.
Probably the highest rated thing on TV in Britain that night.
No, not just that night. It drew massive numbers. Like 26 million or something.
Did you watch the Beijing one then? Because I think a big
controversy. I did, yes. Yeah.
Was it
well, of course,
than
that, yes, setting the scene, the Beijing one was such an extraordinary, you know, technical and organisational and just achievement and spectacle. It really was a very striking moment in many ways. And it was sort of China sort of declaring itself upon the world stage in a way. It was this massive display of hubris and what a well-organized and drilled workforce can achieve, you know.
You sound like you're quoting from a Guardian article.
That's just how I talk, James. I'm very erudite and smug and left-wing.
Are you a Guardianista that I hear so much about?
I am a bleeding heart Guardianista, absolutely. I have a little badge.
Does that go with your child catcher t-shirt?
It's the same one, yes. So obviously that was foremost in everyone's mind watching this amazing spectacle. Half their mind was, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And the other half was, we're never going to top this. I mean, just forget about it, you know.
I think they had like 10 times the budget or something like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it would cost our entire GDP for the next decade or something to... Just the fireworks alone probably cost more than we spend on, you know, education. So
I think we're making the wrong priority choices, though, to be honest.
Less education, more fireworks.
I reckon then the priority for the next government should be fireworks, fireworks, fireworks.
Everybody loves fireworks.
I reckon. I'd vote for someone if they came along and said that. Get back to the old Roman way of doing things.
Fireworks.
They love their fireworks, the Romans. And the Mongolians.
they bloody loved it. Get me started on Mongolian firework culture. I'll go all night.
But then, yeah, so plucky Britain had to follow the massive behemoth of Chinese coordination.
Yes, and as I guess many people anticipated or hoped, we didn't try to compete on the same terms, but by sort of playing to our strengths a bit more.
Mm.
And obviously, as directed by Danny Boyle, and that casting, that sort of that hiring decision alone, sort of I think gave many people the idea that this could be something
interesting.
Maybe, yeah, something more interesting, something competing on a different sort of artistic level, perhaps than the Beijing extravaganza.
Mm.
There might be a bit more to it than just fireworks, fireworks, fireworks. Although that's fine, obviously.
Yeah, I didn't actually watch the Beijing one, to be honest. I think it was on at a stupid time of the night or something.
It was on for like a week.
It's a busy week. What can I say?
Yeah, fair enough.
But yeah, I think, as you say, the fact they hired Danny Butler, it could have been spectacularly horribly wrong. If they'd have just gone, you know, corporate and just said, right, you know, the London Olympic Committee is going to plan this and they're going to deliver it and it's going to reflect everything that's good about Britain. So then have a focus group and work out what's good about Britain and probably won't come up with much. But giving one person their, I'm sure he had a lot of like restrictions on him, but their idiosyncratic view of what was good about Britain made it, I think, a lot more human.
I think it just had just enough humanity and idiosyncrasy to really work, while still, just due to the very nature of the event, it still obviously was something that a lot of committees and focus groups had been involved in. Just, you know, there were some things that were never going to happen, you know what I mean? It's
what you mean, like a live, giant, dead baby crawling across the top of the Olympic Stadium?
That's a good example. Nearly dead. They could have built a giant Olympic-sized diving pool in the shape of a shit-filled toilet and had Ewan McGregor dive into it.
Should we know at this point, Danny Boyle has done other films than Trainspotting.
And indeed, I've watched them, and yet I remember very little.
Yes. Well, Life Less Ordinary is, I think, underrated film.
Terrible.
Well, the soundtrack's good.
That's true. The soundtrack. I actually had the soundtrack and I loved it, and so I watched the film and it was terrible. We're digressing.
Yes. I don't believe I ever promised to not digress.
Okay, well, it's more than just that we were not digressing interestingly. So I'm
going
to be quite...
I don't think I've made any promises on that score.
I intend to be quite strict on pointless, boring digressions.
Right, well, let's just have a 5-minute podcast, shall we then, Neil?
Sounds good. Let's get through this shit, yeah.
Yes. Well,
where were we?
An opening ceremony is kind of an odd thing, because it's like you have to entertain lots of people with none of the things you would normally use to entertain people. So you can't have narrative, you can't have competition. So you have to, I suppose there was a bit of narrative, but you have to go straight for the spectacle.
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting sort of form, and it's kind of a form unto itself. You know, it's sort of a bit like theatre or sort of a grand dance display, or, you know, there's, you know, obviously elements of sporting sort of reference in it. But yeah, it's an unusual sort of mishmash of things. And actually, one thing I thought was really, really successful about this one was that it was a narrative. The first half hour or so, at least, it turned into more of a just sort of, woohoo, let's just do lots of different crazy opening ceremony type stuff later on, and it felt more sort of traditional. But the first sequence, you know...
The Iron of...
Whatever. The extended pantomime remake of The Scouring of the Shire.
Complete with rings.
I thought, yeah, the bit with the rings, the bit with the forging of the five rings to rule them all. I thought it was actually, you know, really quite extraordinary. I was sitting there gobsmacked for large chunks of that, and it was a sustained narrative. You know, that was the thing, and it was using music and dance and all these amazing, you know, set stuff going on, and giant
peasants.
peasants and giant metal penises rising out of the ground. And it was doing all these things in service of a coherent narrative about Britain, you know, which I thought was really, actually really worked well, you know?
Yeah.
I have no snark. I thought it was really, really good.
I was...
Interesting and successful and moving in a way.
Did you watch it with the whole family?
No, I watched it with half of the family. Okay. The smaller, less patient part of the family was in bed by this point.
Because I actually had Lex down with me, and he stayed up very late that night watching it. And I think that really added to it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Until the bit where the giant Voldemort came along.
Oh, did he not like the giant Voldemort?
No, and that is part of the reason why he stayed up and watched the whole rest of the thing. Because when we tried to put him to bed, he just started screaming. Because of... So, could have maybe done without the giant Voldemort.
I guess they didn't think to put, like, parental advisories on an opening ceremony.
That was on.
But yeah, it got pretty scary there. Yes. If you're four.
But, I mean, it just... I may sound like a bit of a wuss, but several points through it, I was getting a bit, you know, bleary-eyed and manly holding back the tears so I didn't embarrass
really?
Myself in front of my child. Yeah, it was very emotional.
Which bits did you find particularly affecting in that way?
I thought when Mary Poppins came and chased off Voldemort, that was amazing.
Oh, that was pretty sweet, yeah.
And the Abide With Me, I thought that was beautiful.
Yeah, that was... I sort of missed the start of that section, so I wasn't quite sure what was happening, but it was very beautiful. Mm. I would have to agree. There seemed to be some interpretive dance going on that was rather lovely, even if I wasn't quite sure what it was saying. I felt like I knew what it was saying, even if I didn't know what it was supposed to be saying.
I was thinking it was about death or something, probably.
Essentially, yes. But... something fun like that. So that bit, right? You know, there's this whole controversy about the American broadcaster not showing, I think, that bit, right? Or there was like a tribute to...
There was a photographic tribute of... That was a bit ill-defined, though, because it was kind of... It seemed like it was going to be about the, you know, the bombings the day after we got the Olympics.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, the controversy is that the American broadcaster declined to air a moving tribute to the 7/7 victims, which would be an extraordinary thing. But watching it that night, I didn't get the sense that that was what that was, or I was a bit confused about what... They were like, we're honouring people who are dead.
Yeah.
And it was like the friends and family of the people who were there or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it was moving in anyway, and, you know, I'm not going to argue about, oh, were they honouring these people who are dead or these people who are dead, because, you know, everyone's going to die, and I think it's worth making that a universal statement.
That should have been the whole theme of the entire ceremony. You're all going to die and turn to
welcome to
dust.
London 2012. These people are going to do some amazing, amazing things, and then they're going to die. And so are you, probably sooner.
Mm.
Yeah, that would have been a bold artistic statement, yeah. But no, I thought to touch on, you know, themes of industrialization and, you know, mortality and all these things. It was an ambitious affair. And all right. So, well, another obviously big talking point about the opening ceremony in the time afterward was the way it really brought out the racism in racists and made them make fools of themselves by splurging their racist hate mongery all over the internet, or their national daily newspapers.
Well,
now,
you
James,
would say that as a gardenista.
Yeah, I would as a gardenista. Now, you, on the other hand, are, as we all know, a massive racist. So how did you feel about the, for example, the musical section towards the end and all the hundreds of rappers who don't apparently exist in the real world and were only there to appease the gardenistas like me?
I thought it was political correctness gone mad, you know. Because where were the Mongolians?
They were in the parade, right? With all the other nations.
To be honest, I went to bed during the parade.
You didn't sit through the parade?
I didn't sit through the parade. I think we had it on while we were kind of loading the dishwasher, etc. And then we came back and it was on the G's. And I thought, okay, well, we'll just wait for Great Britain.
Jesus Christ, and why am I even having this discussion with you? Do you think Melvin Bragg sits down to review a play and he goes, oh, I only watched half of it, I was taking a shit, loading the dishwasher.
Yes,
But the bits I saw looked quite good.
I think Melvin Bragg constantly loads the dishwasher while watching a play.
And doing poos.
Doing poos in the dishwasher. He's an animal.
What are you saying about Melvin Bragg?
He's an animal. I'm saying he doesn't follow basic rules of toilet decency.
Or reviewing decency.
Yes.
So you piked out before the Parade of Nations, despite that being the whole point of the evening.
Well, didn't most of the world?
I don't know, maybe. I sat through it because, you know, that's... Well, because I wanted to see the end.
Mum said she got to Cuba and then she went to bed.
I mean, it just went on so long. I couldn't believe what was happening. Like... I finished two drinks and we were still only on Comoros or something. Which isn't even a country, I swear to God. But they all come out and you're like, oh, that's interesting. This is just really nice, you know.
They all look very happy.
I like seeing happy people from all over the world wearing amusing costumes, walking around and waving. It's just nice, you know.
And then cutting to shots of Prince Charles and Camilla laughing at them. That was always
Yes. and the Queen just staring with dead, hate-filled eyes.
To be fair, she had just jumped out of an aeroplane, you know.
Oh yeah, we haven't even mentioned that part, did
that
we?
That bit was awesome.
That was so... I couldn't believe what was happening. It was so funny as well, because I originally had the intention that I would watch it and sort of tweet along in this, as people do in the modern world, you know?
As hate-filled, but, soulless, evil people do.
Well, you know, a lot of people do this sort of thing, so I thought that looks like fun, I'm going to try doing that. But I can't do that. I was watching, I was absorbed, you know? I managed one tweet about, like, in the first 5 minutes, and then that was it for me. I was just watching the thing. But I sort of did sort of scroll through them all afterwards, and that you could see the point where the Queen and James Bond had appeared, because it just devolved into one word expletives, basically. Just, you could see Twitter having a collective just breakdown.
The ultimate crossover.
It was amazing. Yeah, it really was quite extraordinary. And very, very funny. Which is not something I think anyone was expecting from
the Queen.
Or the Queen, for that matter. Yes.
She plays a deadpan thing well.
She does. She does. It's almost as if she only has one mode of personality.
Well, I didn't quite get the artistic shots of corgis that they seem to be.
Yeah, the weird sort of slow-mo. They at least did feel like they were from Trainspotting or something. Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, we talked about a lot about all the good stuff we liked. Was there anything you...
Well, just still on the good things. I don't think we've even... there's probably going to be 1,000 things we forgot. But you won't have seen this, or you might have seen it in the news since, because you piked out like a, I'm a bit tired. So you went to bed and missed the actual lighting of the Olympic torch.
I did, yeah.
Right?
I saw David Beckham going through the Thames on his motorbike with the smuggest look in the world on his face.
Yeah, well, I mean, the lighting of the Olympic torch was one of the bits that got to me a bit, and I thought was really a beautiful idea, and well, just so in spirit of the whole thing. Which was that rather than having, you know, the most famous or the most representative or the most emblematic person light the torch, they got like 7 of our greatest athletes and Olympians to give give 7 torches to like up and coming young unknown athletes, and then they all went and lit the torch together.
To pass, you know, the torch, people, as it were.
Yes, and you know, it seems so obvious, but I thought it was a really, you know, nice touch. And it came together wonderfully, and the torch itself was an amazing construction, and sort of seeing it all come together over the whole evening, and it was almost worth sitting through the Parade of Nations, because they all brought a bit of the torch with them, you see, and then it got constructed out of them all.
Mm.
It was like the symbolism and the sort of the visual metaphor of it all really was, you know, seamless, I thought, and that's what you want, right?
Yes.
Nice bit of seamless visual metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, it looked quite nice when you watched the brief bit on the news the next day, but yeah, I did wish I could have stayed up.
It was very cool.
But just that constant stream of people walking, and you know,
the next day, me and I would
calculations.
Me and I were just a mess the next day. It was awful. We were so tired just because we stayed up late for once. And like, why are we so tired? Because of Comoros, bloody Comoros, and their ilk.
He's racist.
So I thought there was a lot to love and admire about it. Any downsides?
Well, the giant. In fact, it wasn't even the giant Voldemort. It's the giant baby freak Lex out. So he now won't watch any of the Olympics because he thinks they're going to be giant children.
Oh, really? Oh my god, that's a shame. Logan's quite hooked on it. He loves the swimming.
Does he?
Yeah, he quite likes the cycling as well, but he loves watching people swim.
But the fact they had a giant tribute to the NHS, which they seem to do just to annoy Americans, it was fantastic.
And, you know,
the right wing.
Tory right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and no, I thought that was really cool. I felt, you know, as an artistic work, as I said, I found the first section, you know, the forging of the rings and all that, just absolutely stunning. And after that, it perhaps couldn't help but sort of lose focus a bit.
Yeah.
And became a bit more, and now we'll have a skit about this, and now we'll have a skit about that. And sort of praising the NHS while doing a sort of giant theatrical tribute to giants of children's literature, while having a song and dance number, sort of while having... A lot of it I sort of found entertaining, but it didn't sort of awe me in the way of that first section.
No, but you couldn't have constant awe, could you? I thought it hit a lot of different tones, and it hit them all very well. That'd be how.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, And, you know, it says something about the sort of the power of the occasion and the sort of context of excitement that I watched an extended Mr. Bean routine and found it funny and charming.
Yeah, well, I got so into it, I was whooping Tim Berners-Lee. It's like, yeah, it's Tim Berners-Lee!
I got really excited. So, yeah.
Which also, I don't think I'd even tweeting. Do if he walked past me.
I wouldn't recognise him if he walked past me. But, yeah.
If you had one of those people walking past cool. in front of him with, like, the sign on the arrow saying Tim Berners-Lee, then maybe you're, like the countries did. It was my reference.
Yes. I think that was in his rider, actually. He now gets that for life.
Okay. So, yeah, I think we liked the Olympic opening ceremony. There was one thing, though. It's like, it's all about, you know, celebrating athletes and all that. But they get celebrated all the time. So, why about, you know, when are you going to have the office worker Olympics or the, I don't know, street sweeper Olympics or something?
That you're not, because those people are scum and boring.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
the Golga French and B-Arc Olympics is what you're after.
Exactly. The middle class Olympics.
One day, James, one day. They are the middle class Olympics. Haven't you heard this statistic about how some preposterously high proportion of our Olympic team are privately educated? Because, obviously, you know, because who the fuck does rowing and, you know, eventing, you know? A lot of these events are things you just could not get into.
So you're talking upper middle class, though? Because I'm thinking middle class.
Okay. Straight down the line, middle class Olympic.
Right in the middle. Nothing interesting or, you know, exceptional about them at all. But where's their Olympics?
Oh, I do have one major downside to the event. A celebration of all that is greatest and best in Britain. And touching on all these great cultural things we've given to the world. Where the fuck was Doctor Who then? Eh? Eh?
That was a TARDIS sound.
I didn't even hear that. I heard about it afterwards, but I assumed it was all going to climax with the TARDIS materialising and K-9 coming out.
Yeah, that, it does seem Doctor Who would have been a very good fit for it.
I thought so. On the other hand, David Tennant was nowhere to be seen, which means that terrible episode of Doctor Who with David Tennant carrying the Olympic torch now officially never happened, and now no one ever has to watch
it
again.
Expunged from the record.
It can be purged from history.
Yeah, but
yes.
I don't think we've had, you know, Cybermen ghosts coming out of Canary Wharf yet either, and wasn't that supposed to have happened by now? Or?
We might.
I don't think you can use that criterion, Neil.
Alright, fair enough.
Otherwise we'd get rid of a lot of Doctor Who.
Let's just strike the last 2 minutes of me talking from the record then, because I make myself sound quite foolish.
I can't be bothered. I'd much rather have you sounding foolish.
Fair enough. Let's plough right on then. Okay, the Olympic opening ceremony. I thought it was terrific. 9 out of 10. I'm feeling in the spirit of the things.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be that guy, but, you know, if they'd have cut out some of those countries or just made them walk quicker or just maybe some kind of speeded up Benny Hill style, then walking around. Then I could have got to see.
I think for next year, bikes.
Yeah, maybe. Surely. Or segways.
Yeah. Or just drive them round.
One clown car, and then every single Olympic athlete gets out of it.
That's not bad. Not bad at all.
But I'm still going to give it 9.3 for the bit I watched, because it was touching, brilliant, genius that made me proud to be British, and I think very much captured something which is very elusive, which is what it means to be British these days and what, you know, our country's all about.
Yes, I guess so. I don't know if I'd go that... Yeah, why not? I'll go that far. Also, it did something very amazing, which was made me sort of forget all the reasons I was feeling cynical and unenthusiastic about the Olympics, and sort of made me excited about the whole thing. And yes. All right, well, that's an epically high score, then, for the Olympics. It's one of the highest scoring things ever reviewed on Unify Review Theory.
Good. Well,
with a 9.15 out of 10.
Yeah, I think it earned
Bump
it
up to 9.2. Round up.
Yeah. Good on you, Danny Boyle, and all your volunteers who helped you.
Should have had more Doctor Who.
Should have had more Doctor Who. Well, it would have got 10 if it had Doctor Who, I think.
Yeah, I think it would.
Good.
Anyway.
Okay, well, that's that. Cool. Should we have a quick review?
Okay.
Okay, quick review.
Quick review.
Let's review racism.
I don't like it.
I think it's bad.
I cannot get behind it as a concept.
Boo racism.
Fundamentally flawed. 1 out of 10.
So you think it does have some good qualities?
Well, it gives people a hobby, I suppose.
It common, like, you know, friendly, bantery racism when the people who have been racist are, they've been racist against a majority, you know? Is that...
I don't know. I don't think you can give anything 0 out of 10, because that would say it has no... You know, there is utterly no merit. And it's like, you know, even the Daleks, you know, as we learned in Genesis of the Daleks, even the Daleks brought some good to the universe, the countries, the whole planets that united against them and forged alliances, and the human strength over adversity that came because the Daleks existed. So, to my mind, if Tom Baker couldn't bring himself to destroy the Daleks utterly in Genesis of the Daleks, then I should be able to give 1 out of 10 to racism. That's a coherent argument, right?
Yep. I'm going to give it 10 out of 10 because it is the right way of thinking.
Oh, I forgot, yeah, massive racist.
No.
Okay.
No, I'm going to give it 1.5 out of 10 because, as I say, you know, I don't mind if someone calls me a honky unless they're kind of doing it while not liking me. So, and
there is a spectacular litany of racist abuse words, you know, which obviously there are many which are impossible to even say out loud, but some are just really funny. Generally the ones directed at, you know, yourself.
Like, and it's good fun say, accusing people of racism as well, as you've shown so many times.
That is one of my favourite hobbies, you dirty racist.
Good, okay, so racism gets 1.25 out of 10. Racism is worse than the Olympic opening ceremony.
We'll round that one down, though, because it's racist, okay, to 1.2.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
Okay.
So what's our next big review then?
Okay, well, for our next major topic this evening, we are going to be reviewing a comic, which in itself is quite unusual.
But aren't comics just for kids, Neil?
Not anymore. Biff, pow, not anymore. On that, we are, however, going to be reviewing a comic that is decidedly
definitely for children.
Yes. It's not a thing we do often, despite both being fairly nerdy, big comic fans, and me being, that's kind of my job and stuff. Hello. So, it is a hell of a comic that we're going to be talking about this evening.
Yes. So, which comic are we talking about?
We are going to be discussing The Amazing Story, and it's got that right there in the title, so it's not just me saying that. The Amazing Story of Superman Red and Superman Blue, originally published in Superman issue 162 from July 1963, written by Leo Dorfman and with art by the astonishing Kurt Swan and George Klein.
Not the Swanderson team, then?
No, the Squillane team.
Yes.
Yes.
I take it you've just read this because it was your idea to review it.
I've just reread it. Yeah. Yes, I borrowed from you, as you know, but our readers may not, a collection of DC's Greatest Imaginary Stories, which is a hugely entertaining volume, and I recommend it to anyone who likes wacky Silver Age nonsense, as I do. But it contains several, I mean, mostly great Superman stories. Mm. Like, the imaginary story is basically a Superman form, you know.
But then, aren't they all imaginary stories?
Yes. Good point, Alan Moore. Thanks for bringing that up.
But this is more imaginary than others.
This is extraordinarily imaginary.
So imaginary stories are when DC wanted to basically have a really good cover, but not change any of the status quo at all.
Well, yeah, so to set the scene, you know, the Silver Age DC Comics, Superman, some people might... I don't know what level of background with comics our listeners may have. Probably quite high.
I would imagine fairly high.
But just to set the scene, the DC publishers of Superman, Batman, etc., in the 60s, which is sort of the heyday of Superman, in a way, or certainly my
definitely
preferred
the heyday
era.
I don't think it's got better.
They didn't really have what has become sort of the hallmark of superhero comics, which is this sort of elaborate sort of ongoing continuity, if you like. They were very much, you read a story and it pretty much started and ended in the same place.
Mm. So like American TV shows, like pre-Lost, they could never change anything.
Yes, exactly. There was this status quo, and they would... And so Superman would always, you know, Lois Lane was never going to find out who Superman was. They were never going to get married. That was crazy talk. There was only so much you could do. You could have all sorts of amazing stories of Superman solving crimes or fighting monsters or going to various planets, but the fundamental setups of Superman and his situation couldn't really change. And that's the strength of these stories, in a way, and how accessible and hugely popular they were, and I think, is that they could be picked up by, you know, any child who it was their first comic, or any child who'd never read that character before, or any child who'd never, you know, hadn't read one for a couple of months, and that wasn't a problem. You read it up and you got a great story, or three in one issue of a comic, which were completely intelligible to you, and that there was no sort of prior knowledge needed going in.
Mm. You could read them in any order. You could just pick up anything any time.
Yeah, and that's the way they worked. You saw one that had an exciting looking cover, I guess, and thought, oh, I'll spend my whatever ridiculous price they cost, like 0.2 of a pence on this amazing comic.
But it's also, they needed to contain the illusion of change, because they got rid of all the interesting... The fact that, oh, how, it's a guy who can fly and, you know, he's really strong. And that was exciting for a few years, and then it's like, okay, yeah, we get it. And so if they're going to keep on people reading, then they needed to at least have the illusion of change. So you'd always have someone discovering that Clark Kent was Superman, but then getting amnesia at the end, or, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you had such a fixed, set-in-stone status quo, the most exciting thing you could do, and, you know, such a giant proportion of the stories I've read from this era, is to flirt with changing that status quo. Either by sort of having someone discover Clark Kent's secret identity, you know, but then there's a trick, or he manages to get out of it, and then it's all back where it starts at the end, or by doing this sort of second subset of stories, the imaginary stories, which where the writers were allowed to actually change stuff, but given the precept, sort of the understanding that this wasn't really a story. It was a story which may or may not ever happen, unlike all the other ones, which definitely did happen.
They happened. Yeah. Because if they didn't happen, we'd have to get rid of them, like Doctor Who, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it really is a weird idea that they needed this sort of, these ones are imaginary, these ones are real thing. But it seems like once they'd sort of got that idea over, it just, everyone ran with it, you know? Like, kids go, yeah, okay, I get that. Mm. Yeah. This is imaginary. This isn't the real Superman.
I think it's very kind of, that is how children think, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it's a very natural idea, and once they'd got that, they really ran with it. Like, particularly, as I say, with the Superman mythos. Mm.
So and just to give a brief, very brief plot synopsis, basically. The Kandorians tell Superman... The Kandorians live in a bottle.
The Kandorians are people from Krypton, Superman's home planet, who live in a bottle because they got shrunk and put in it by Brainiac, the villain with the best name ever.
Yes. I think we've reviewed Brainiac on the site at some point.
We have. He's brainy. He's a maniac. He's Brainiac.
So they kind of... Even though Superman has spent his entire life helping people, saving the world, saving the universe again and again and again, Kandorians drag him away from his, you know... In fact, it starts off very low-key, doesn't it? It starts off with everyone else in the Daily Planet getting a raise, and he doesn't.
Everyone got a raise but Clark. Everyone at the Daily Planet, the other three people who work at this major...
And in fact, the editor, Perry White, puts this up on the wall in front of the entire office and has himself at the top of the list getting the biggest raise, which seems a bit self-aggrandizing to me.
He does, yes. He has himself at the top of the list. Then Lois Lane gets $10 increase a month. Jimmy Olsen, $5. And they bother to put at the bottom, Clark Kent, no increase.
You'll get nothing.
How about that? Everyone got a raise but Clark.
We've dealt with this like in a one-to-one meeting. No! The whole office must know you're a failure.
But there are like 200 other people who work at this paper. Why have you put my name up there as getting no increase? That just seems pathologically cruel.
So never mentioned again, I don't think. But yeah, so that's how the story starts, and then
yes, absolutely. It begins with so basically Superman is getting bawled out for being a loser, in his civilian identity, and then when he gets back to his awesome Fortress of Solitude, which is a whole other thing that I love so much, I can't begin to tell you. He gets called out for being a loser by the tiny bottle people he keeps as pets.
Yeah, it's like, what have you been doing? It's been years and you haven't eradicated all evil on Earth.
Which... Yes, the list of tasks they feel he should have accomplished by this point.
Which can't be that many years because, you know, Jimmy Olsen hasn't got any older. So we can only be talking about 3 or 4 years at the most.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They are hard. They set aggressive quarterly targets for Superman, these people, and they expect him to perform. He is expected to restore Candle City to normal size, which is kind of fair enough. You can see where they're coming from with that, right?
That was obviously what they wanted to happen, and they just thought, well, we don't want to appear that selfish. Let's, you know, make it seem like, you know, we care about what happens to the Earth as well.
Yeah, he's supposed to find an antidote to green kryptonite, which, again, I don't know, it seems like, you know, it's a specific problem specific to them, but maybe if he put his mind to it, he ought to be able to come to that. But he's also supposed to wipe out crime and evil. Full stop. Which is quite an ask, because they're kind of abstract concepts inherent in our very nature as human beings.
Do you think this was their roundabout way of asking him to wipe out humanity?
maybe. So make us bigger, then wipe out all the humans. It's an aggressive list of demands, as I say. And Superman doesn't feel up to the task.
No, well, he's had, you know, years to do these impossible things and hasn't managed it. So he needs a little help. He needs a little druggy help.
Yeah, well, it doesn't exactly take drugs.
Well, so it's performance-enhancing kryptonite, basically.
He gets in a special spangly machine that has all sorts of kryptonite in it, and it's going to boost his mental power 100 times, so then he will be able to wipe out all crime and evil on Earth. So I guess you could see it as a form of... it's performance-enhancing drugs. Good message, Superman. If you're feeling down, take drugs. Okay, so then Superman's experiment with self-enhancement goes horribly, horribly wrong. It seems like the machine has done terrible things, but actually, it's all gone horribly, horribly right, and somehow it has turned him into 2 Supermans.
So better than 1 Superman.
One is all red, and one is all blue. Hence the title of the story, if you remember where we came in. The amazing story of Superman Red and Superman Blue. You have to agree,
it'd be a bit weird if it was all red and blue.
That's true, yes. So basically, they're just both in Superman suits, but one has a blue cape and one has a red body. It looks kind of cool as well. That's the thing.
Mm. It's like variant editions, you know. It's always good to...
It's a really striking visual, I think. And also, they are both 100 times brighter than one Superman was on his own. And, I don't know if we need to go through the entire thing beat by beat, but basically they do it all.
They do it all, and more.
They do, and so much more, yes. And that's the really interesting thing, I think, about this story, is in a way, it isn't a story.
Mm.
Like, there is no substantial conflict in this story.
It's split into 3 bits, and they kind of, sort of, come up with mini cliffhangers between the 2 bits, but they only last a panel, so...
Tiny, mini, sort of, fake-out cliffhangers. Because, basically, Superman solves all the problems in existence quite early on, and then he just gets to sort of chill and have a nice time.
Have a beer. Seventh day relax type thing.
Yeah, and it just sort of... there is no major conflict. He does wipe out crime and evil, the abstract concepts inherent in our nature as human beings.
Makes Lex Luthor's hair grow back.
Yeah, I love that completeness to it. Like, there is no T left uncrossed in this story. He makes Lex Luthor's hair grow back. It's the attention to detail of Superman Red and Superman Blue that I really admire.
And then he marries both of the chicks. It's pretty awesome.
That's the thing. The eternal who does he like better of the two women who are always competing for his affection is fine, because happily one of the Supermans just happens to prefer Lois Lane and the other happens to prefer Lana Lang, and so they get married to them and have children and settle down, and it's just all oddly beautiful, frankly.
It's amazing. It is, I think, my favourite Superman story ever.
I think it's my favourite Superman story ever, and therefore I think there's a claim to be made that it's the greatest superhero story ever.
I could go with that. I mean, it's so... when I first read it, I wasn't a big Superman fan. I mean, I think I read your X-Men comics, and that was, you know, where it was coming from. It was the mid-80s. Or, you know,
sure.
Early 90s, actually. And then I got, because it was vaguely cheap, I got the greatest Superman stories ever, and... the two that just blew me away, there was that one, and right before it, there was The Death of Superman, which was another imaginary one. Which was
collected here as well, which, and again, is extraordinary.
It is the opposite of this one. It is everything bad happens. And
That's the down ending to the Superman story, yeah.
Yeah, it's Lex Luthor just kills Superman in a horrible, protracted, harrowing way.
He's tortured, he's crying in pain for several pages, and then he dies. And then Luthor just drops off his dead body with the line, "You can have Superman back now that he's dead." Ha ha!
Yeah.
Kind of amazing.
Just they are the two, you know, epitomes of, it's just purely distilled what made Superman great. I mean, obviously you couldn't do that every single story because it would quickly lose its impact, but it's just like all of these things that, you know, they're struggling against that keep on coming back and back, and he's fighting Lex Luthor again and again, and, you know, there's always candles, always whining about being in a bottle and all that stuff, and it's just, you know, let's just finish it. Let's just give you the resolution for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the amazing power of the amazing story of Superman Red and Superman Blue and The Death of Superman, those two stories, is that, you know, we were talking about the status quo of Superman being this incredibly sort of strong, fixed, set in stone thing, and so basically you've got Superman's origin story, which is one of the greatest sort of things you can do with Superman, and that origin story got retold a lot and referenced a lot. You know, Superman rocketed to Earth as a baby from dying planet, grew up to become Superman. It's amazing, and the whole character of Superboy is kind of an extended way of retelling that origin story almost. Then you have sort of just Superman having adventures and performing feats in the modern world, which none of them are quite as none of them are as good a story as the origin story, you know. Mm. But the thing that competes is the end, the final story, you know, the
Gotham
final
Dameron,
Superman story.
The
is that
Superman.
Is that what that is?
Mm?
Yes, absolutely. And so I think the greatest Superman story you can tell is the end of how it all ends, where it all goes. And so you've got two strong contenders there from the Silver Age. And then you've got, and the greatest writers of Superman, I think, have realised this and have done interesting things with it. You had Alan Moore's Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, which was a story about the end of the Superman mythos.
And one of the only stories that could compete with these ones, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's astonishing. Kurt Swan again, right?
Mm.
Just beautiful. And then, more recently, you have Grant Morrison's All-Star Superman, which is, again, it's kind of an extended sort of remix of these very tales. I'd say it's the end of Superman and how the legend winds up, and sort of using playing with all the power of that, you know. Mm. Superman's last days, and also his DC 1 Million to some extent, I'd say.
That one issue where it's the Superman saga of all of his descendants, that is, I think it's when you just really mainline Superman as a god, basically, and the mythology of Superman.
Yeah, and that's what these stories really bring out, you know, which maybe gets forgotten a bit in when he's just flying around beating up bank robbers or whatever. But yeah, they really play up the divinity of the symbolism of that character. And
I think for some reason my favourite bit of the story is when he makes a water bridge between Earth and what used to be his Kryptonian memorial planet.
Yes.
And the entire population of Atlantis then swim from one planet to another, which you think would take a while, but I don't know. Maybe
I mean, it just makes no force. It makes no kind of sense at all. Let's face it. But it's amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah, and then one of them just says, "In centuries to come, our ancestors will think of this as a myth," and it's just.
It describes it as an epic exodus. It is an epic exodus. It is genuinely sort of biblical stuff, but silly and wacky and Silver Age.
And this is like half a page out of the story. And it's you know, as good
as almost this weird little detour. You know, oh yeah, we need to get a whole new planet for the Atlanteans. Oh, let's arrange this epic.
Let's melt the ice caps, flood an entire planet, and then create a water bridge between there and Earth, and then that's it. Job done.
It's pretty astonishing.
We'll come and visit you soon.
and that's the thing. It really does cover off everything about the Superman legend, from the Atlanteans to Lex Luthor's hair. And I think that's what's so special about this story, and why I love it so dearly, is because it gets across what I enjoy so much about those stories. In that, as I was saying, they don't really have this sort of ongoing. You know, you need to read one issue to find out, to understand the next continuity that we're sort of familiar with from modern comics. But they do have this sort of accumulation of detail, you know? Mm. Like, the legend of Superman becomes sort of gradually more ornate.
The mythology.
The mythology, exactly. It fills out and you learn more about Krypton and the habits of the Kryptonians, and you get things like the Bottle City of Kandor, and then that doesn't go away, and then their story's set there, you know? And then it all becomes just gradually more elaborate, and I love the idea that, because these stories were so popular, you know, that's the thing, the print runs of these things were enormous. I don't know figures off the top of my head, but you know, these were, it was such a giant, you know, pop cultural thing in the time it was being published. And I just love the image of, and you have some of these in original issues, right?
And
the letters
awesome.
Pages the letters pages you get in these comics are just so great, because it's they really communicate the sense of just this nation of children lapping up every issue of this comic and trying to outwit it and spot all the faults in it.
Yes.
Because they've taken this mythology and it is their mythology.
Which,
you know,
in turn impacts on how the stories are written, because you then have the people writing all these convoluted thought bubbles saying, I can't be doing this because that would happen, but then this would happen, and then...
It becomes this, it's like a sort of crossword puzzle story. Mm. It's this game between the writers and their child readers, which is quite charming. Oh, it's silly and preposterous sometimes, but very charming at other times. And I think it works right up until the point that, unfortunately, those children grow up and become comics writers.
Yeah.
Because then, it just sort of all went wrong at some point. But this is absolutely the height of that sort of the high Kryptonian era almost. And I think it's a really interesting and beautiful sort of phenomenon in the medium of comics.
Mm. It's separate to the general, you know, mass of Superman comics from that age, but it's in a way an epitome of, and in another way a discussion of. I think it's if you boiled it all down, all those many, because it's worth reading all the other many, many issues from that time, because they're all really good, but obviously none of them are game changers like this.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is it in its purest form.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, that they are really great comics. That, like, some people have expressed the opinion, I know a lot of comics nerds, as you know, and I've heard people who seemed like otherwise sane people express the idea that Superman is a boring character, or is not a sort of, is a lame or poorly conceived character. And
which, if you read Superman comics in the 90s, you could be forgiven for thinking.
No, it's understandable, but you know, if you've read good Superman comics, it's inexplicable. Mm. And also, you can't say that Superman isn't a good character if you like other superhero comics, because Superman is the concept of the superhero. You know, all other superhero comics are reactions to, or sort of other takes on Superman. Increasingly these days, you'd think it'd be less so, but the number of comics I've read these days that are just sort of not even coming up with new characters, just analogs of Superman, you know. Mm. And sort of,
that's
so they
I
can
don't
do
read superhero
so much
anymore,
of the comics industry these days is essentially out. Imaginary Superman stories doing things that they could not do in the actual Superman world, but rather than, you know, in the old days, killing him off or having him marry Lois Lane. These days, it's, you know, oh, imagine if Superman liked to rip dudes' guts out. Imagine if Superman raped people.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, it's so awful. It barely makes me cry. But
they're still there, the Silver Age ones. You can always go back and read them. And they are for children, but like you can read a Tintin or something like that, and it's just the pure simplicity of the storytelling. And
A lot of great comics and a lot of great literature have been created for children. There is nothing wrong with that. And it just, we're saying these are genuinely great comics, and we haven't really mentioned a huge part of that, of course, is the artwork.
Yeah.
The storytelling and the clarity of line and just the sheer astonishing competence of illustration, you know, like Kurt Swan was just so good at drawing, you know.
He could draw a Superman.
he could draw human beings just incredibly well. And then, obviously, and they all have this slightly sort of stolid 50s Americana quality to them. But that's so utterly charming. And they look so much more like real people than anyone you would see in a superhero comic in the last 30 years, you know.
It's because they're not contorting themselves in strange ways all the time.
No, but it's got... It looks quite sort of straightforward or staid in terms of their poses and in terms of the page layouts and the panel layouts. It generally sort of stays on the horizontal, things like that. But that's what makes it really easy to read and, you know, really clear storytelling and that a child can pick up and just understand immediately. And, yes, I'm starting to sound negative and sort of, oh, things were better in the old days, and obviously I do not entirely feel this to be the case. But
no,
I think
you still have great comics like The Phoenix, of course.
Well, of course. But, you know, everything that was great about the old days is represented, I think, by this particular story. And we're not making fun of things and being rude. We're just sort of extolling virtues. We're being really genuine and saying how much we love
them,
you
know.
Well, I think we've probably said about all we have to say.
Yeah, it's really good. If you haven't read it, you should go and read it. If you have read it, you should go and read it again. And
yeah, absolutely.
Buy a big bunch of Superman Silver Age comics.
I think I need to do that, yeah.
But then maybe don't spend your, if you're a comics professional, entire career commenting on and...
Oh, God, yeah, no, read them and move on. Read them and understand. If you're going to take a lesson from this comic as a comic creator, let it be, you know, the power of imagination and the power of clear, beautiful storytelling, and the ideas that you come up with out of your brain can become something much greater than themselves and can be adored by a nation of children if they are good enough ideas. Just be inspired rather than inspired to imitate, I would say.
Amen. So I've kind of back myself into a corner now when it comes to marking, though, because I think Superman Red and Blue is better than the Olympics opening ceremony.
Do you know what? I'd have to agree.
If nothing else, I've read the whole thing.
I don't know if Superman Red and Superman Blue quite sort of brought an entire nation together in the way that the Olympic opening ceremony did. I mean, the Olympic opening ceremony was extraordinary, but no, for me personally, subjectively, this is a more important and more perfect thing.
Mm. So I'm going to give it 9.4, I guess.
I will also give it a 9.4. That sounds good to me.
Well, this is a very high-scoring round of... Racism let the side down slightly. But otherwise...
Yeah, the Olympics opening ceremony, Superman Red and Superman Blue, and racism. We've covered a gamut.
Which will win.
And Superman comes out victorious, I'm happy to say.
Did you ever doubt it? He's Superman.
No. Absolutely. Check it out if you haven't read it. It's a corker.
Yes, good. Okay, well, we'll be back again soon. Or not back again soon, but hopefully back again at some point.
We will be back again soonish, absolutely. And we will be reviewing lots of other fun things. And maybe we'll be, you know, bitter and sarcastic and
Certainly. Let's just choose things we hate so much right now. Next time.
What do we hate?
The left-leaning liberal
media. Oh, dude,
elite.
You know what we should do for balance? We should like review a current issue of Superman.
That would involve reading the current issue of Superman.
Yeah.
Let's review. I don't know. Let's not.
Also,
Superman
it would break my rule to try and not be incredibly snotty and bitter about the state of the comics industry that I work in, somewhat, however tangentially.
I tell you what, should we try and be interactive if people want to? If people have ideas or suggestions, can they tweet us on our Twitter account? Or
Yeah. I'll put something on the blog. But I will actually write a blog post for once, and we will tweet about this. And we'd love to hear suggestions for things to review.
Wicked.
Hey James, have you seen John Carter?
No. Should I?
Have you seen Tintin and the Legend of the Golden Fleece? Mystery of the Golden Fleece.
No.
You should watch either of those things when you review them, because they're both awesome. Oops, I've just blown it.
I thought it was reviewing things we hate.
Oh yeah, okay. No, actually no, John Carter was kind of terrible, now that I think about it. Tintin was awesome. John Carter was kind
of
terrible.
Keeping people on the edge of their seats there with your, you know, double shimmy.
Do I think John Carter is awesome or terrible? Find out next week if James watches it too.
Which he probably won't.
It's terrible.
So goodbye, everyone.
Bye, everyone. Come back next time.
Unified Review Theory. An oasis of certainty in a sea of unranked people, objects, and concepts.